And the government reserved a certain part of the sugar market for domestic production by beets, with sugar beets.
Uh-huh. Oh, is that right?
In other words, they had a quota, the Philippines had a quota. Hawaiian Islands had a quota. They were allowed to ship in a certain amount of cane sugar. Mm-hmm. The Caribbean Islands could ship in a certain amount. And if they got over that, then there was a high tariff on it. Mm-hmm. So it was possible to produce beet sugar in competition because we had a protected market.
Right.
When they stopped protecting the market, by then that was the end of it, at least in California. Mm-hmm. I think there still are some sugar factories in Colorado and Wyoming, maybe. But that was the end of it in California. Yeah.
So it was a question of there was a sugar per hours of labor that it was cheaper to build, to make cane sugar and all with it, cheaper labor and stuff like that. So that was why they would come in from Cuba and all this type of thing. And sugar beets, it wasn't as cost effective maybe but it was protected.
That's right. They couldn't raise, after it wasn't protected, they couldn't raise it.
Okay.
And it had to do with a national defense strategy. It decided that it was thought that the country ought to be able to feed itself, and one of the essential foods was considered to be sugar.
Right.
And I'm sure there was a lot of political chicanery going on. Each guy wanted his crop protected, but...
When did the Bedarabia thing close?
You know, we were gone from there when it closed.
Okay. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we owned the dehydrator. We were the only instance in which the dehydrator belonged to somebody other than the sugar factory. We owned the dehydrator, and when the management changed there, they didn't want us to own the dehydrator anymore.
Oh.
So they bought us out.
So, and then you were basically out of the feed, you were basically in
before,
out of the feed
before that. Before that happened, we had stopped feeding cattle and were selling the dehydrator.
Just the dehydrated thing.
So it's a big dairy feed.
Yeah. And then
we decided that we would do better that way than we would do.
Now, by that time, were you involved in that, or was that basically your dad's?
No,
your
my father died in 1947, and we were continuing that business until 1972 or three.
So
yeah, we were all involved.
So then. Well, that's interesting because I thought you had been raised around here.
No,
I didn't realize.
We spent a lot of time here, but we basically went to school in the Bay Area.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. And the cattle were driven to market until
From this ranch, they drove them to San Miguel, and from the Avenal, they drove them to Santa Margarita.
Oh, okay.
Teresa Plains, they drove to Santa Margarita. I don't know why they drove them to San Miguel instead of Paso Robles. For some reason, but I don't remember.
And then that went on till
I would guess that probably. Probably around 1940 or thereabouts, the trucks were able to do short hauls. They would haul. They couldn't get up to the ranch. They could get here. They couldn't get the Avenal, so it was too steep a hill for them. So we had a place down by Pozo where we'd take them, and then the truck to Santa Margarita and put them on the railroad there. Mm-hmm. And then the long haul trucks came along after the war. Mm-hmm. The long-haul trucks really came into being, I guess you'd say, because the Eisenhower administration Commission made a policy decision that they would build the national highway system.
Right.
They could have made a decision not to do that and to build more railroads.
Right.
But they made the highway decision, and
right.
That's why the railroads went into decline and the trucks into the ascendancy.
Right.
But when we had that, then we would truck them to from the ranches to better area.
So it was a combination of improvement of the mechanical, the trucks, but also the roadbed.
The roads became a big deal.
So
sure.
that solved that.
Yeah. See, the first trucks probably were maybe 30 feet of truck bed. That was all they could haul, and now they have 50. Some of them are double decked.
So let's see, 30 would there be what? A dozen head, 15 head in
well,
that?
Yeah, well, it depends on the size of them.
And a grade.
They haul about, a big truck and trailer, such as you see on the highway, will haul about 25 tons. Mm-hmm. And it's a little different than that. It's so many pounds per axle. Mm-hmm. So that when you see them set up and stop the trucks at the foot of the crescent, they often have a portable scale and they run that truck each axle over that scale to be sure that the guy isn't overloading.
Yeah, yeah, just like the grapes or whatever.
You get pretty hard to overload a cattle truck. You can't get enough animals on it. Well, you can when we ship We always ask the driver how many head he can handle, or how many pounds, and he tells us he can hold 46,000 or 49,000 or whatever it is. Depends a lot on the weight of his tractor. And so then you've got your cattle weight, you figure it out, you put on the number, because you don't want to get in any trouble.
Well, so that was around, I mean, there were a lot of changes in the end of the 30s and the war years.
Yes.
I'm sure that they were brought about by, you know, different social factors.
Oh, sure.
And stuff like that. But then when you came back from the war, did you come more or less here?
Yeah, we had the house. We had already built our house here.
Okay.
We had been here a couple of years, and then we left, and we came back in 3 years.
Uh-huh. And you were in the Navy?
In the Navy.
Okay. Were you on ship or?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
2 years I was on ship.
So. Oh, okay. And you guys lived, I mean, Norma lived down south?
They lived, Norma and her parents rented a house. They rented a huge house. Do you know where Portuguese Bend is?
Very well.
Okay, well, there was a huge house there. The Portuguese, just before you go down another. Where the
slide.
Thing slid. Just this side of the slide, there was a big house belonged to, I can't think of the guy's name now, very well known, very rich guy. It was a big house, and it had been built with stables and places for chauffeurs and servants.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So they had that house, they lived in the house, and they rented out the apartments to mostly the naval officers.
Mm-hmm.
So there always were people around. And that they were very isolated.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you ship out of Long Beach then? Or?
The first ship I was on, I was assigned to a ship under construction in Portland, Oregon.
Well,
I was up there for a while and then it departed and then with that ship, we were up in the Aleutians, and then I came back and I was assigned to a tanker, which then went out in the South Pacific, Central Pacific.
So you weren't in, it was a support fleet, not, it wasn't a tactical or a combat fleet.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the minesweeper was a combination minesweeper and anti-submarine vessel, and had there been any submarines where we were, we would have been, might have been a combat ship. You know, we had all the...
In other words, all you could do was ram them if that was
we had depth charges and all that stuff. Sound gear, depth charges, guns. Yeah. But we were in the Aleutian Islands and there wasn't anything there but stormy weather.
Yeah.
Then the tanker, strange enough, it was supposed to be an oil tanker. It was outfitted for that. But it went out just about the time they had invaded the Marianas, called Saipan. They had to have troops on amphibious vessels for much longer than they had ever contemplated. Mm-hmm. Didn't have enough water for them, so we hauled fresh water for the amphibious force.
Oh, is that right? Now, I wonder how that worked in an oil
tanker.
Well,
we never had any oil.
Oh, I see.
It was brand new.
Uh-huh.
The tanker was brand new, and the first, when they discovered the problem with water, they simply, the next three tankers, there were, you know, maybe a tanker a week coming
right.
out. They were built in Portland, and the next three tankers just
would
never
be water.
Anything but water.
Yeah.
And these amphibious vessels would come along, say, even underway, they'd come alongside and pump their tanks full of water. Sometime later on, we would get ships that had been in combat and had maybe there had been damage and their evaporators weren't working or something. And they'd
uh-huh.
come up alongside
uh-huh.
and we'd go to them and
huh.
give them water. Take about anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to pump out a cargo of water.
And then you'd be back up
to? Go back to wherever. Guam had water, Saipan had water. Water a couple of places in the Philippines, Admiralty Islands.
You don't even
water.
Think about that. You know, I don't think that many people
no.
are even aware of it, but you can imagine.
Well, you I often think about it, listen to the news now, and you think, no, there were 8 people got killed. People don't really remember, it doesn't mean anything to them, but there were 12 million people in the armed forces.
Right.
I mean, they didn't have time to interview the family of every poor devil who got mashed.
Yeah.
Because it was happening every day, all over the place.
Yeah.
What the Navy did, they did something quite different than has ever been done before or since. Their supply depot would be an atoll with a big lagoon. And the supply ships came in there and anchored. And then the combatant ships, carriers and battleships, came in there and got supplied.
Uh-huh.
They came in, drop anchor. When we first went and a week out, there were 1,000 ships at anchor.
That must have been impressive.
Well, that was
you know, I mean, to just see that.
Something to see, yeah.
Yeah, see
but
that.
The big ships, battleships and all, would come in and barges would go around and they'd send their orders to supply officers to put in orders. And then there were, you know, some of the ships like a lot of the transports would have doctors and maybe a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
And
the hospital ships.
Well, yeah, I ever saw a hospital ship out there, but the transports, of course there were a lot, usually had a dentist.
Uh-huh.
If there were enough to go around, probably weren't.
Yeah.
And some of them, if a man needed an operation, like an appendectomy, you tried to get him to a ship that had 2 doctors. So there was one guy to give the anesthesia and the other guy to
uh-huh.
operate on him. I never saw a hospital ship.
Uh-huh.
But I can remember.
Well, and they may have just been going, they may have just been transporting from...
Well, they didn't, they kept the hospital ships at some distance from the operation
mm-hmm.
and isolated and lighted, so there was no excuse for anybody to say, oh, I didn't realize that was a hospital ship,
yeah,
or I was shooting at somebody else.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's why in the big anchorages, there were, and the Wheaton was the first one, and Ulithi was another one, and Gulf of Lady Island was another, and anyway, lots of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of ships in these places.
Yeah, the logistics of that whole thing must have been an amazing.
Unbelievable.
A story that you don't hear about, you know, you hear about the Nimitz's and all this type of thing, but the logistics of how that was put together is something else.
If you like the local, did you ever read about the destroyers that went on the rocks?
Down there at
Point
Honda? Yeah, I've read some of that
stuff. The book?
Yeah.
We went down there one time. We have a friend who was a retired naval officer, and so he got us into the base, and it had to go through Vandenberg to get there. He got us out of the base, and we went down there to look at it. There's still some little debris, not much left.
Yeah, that's something else. Yeah. Well, listen, I tell you,
I gave it to somebody. It takes the history of the oil industry, really, from the time they found oil in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
It's a book about that thick.
If you can think of that time, because I'd love to know it, because I have a lot of, like I have Union Oil's corporate history, and I've got Lada has written.
Well, this book, they did, it's not only the oil in the United States, but it's the history of the finding oil in Arabia, finding oil in Azerbaijan.
Yeah.
And then the Dutch Indies.
Uh-huh.
The guy's got everything in there, but a lot about the United States and old Spindletop in Pennsylvania,
right,
and who the people were.
Right.
Where did how did Hammer get over to Occidental Oil?
Do
you know about him?
Now this is in Pennsylvania.
Armand Hammer owned, he was the principal stockholder in Occidental,
right.
But where he was just, his father was a doctor.
He was a doctor too, wasn't he?
Well, yeah, but he never practiced because right after he graduated from medical school, how the hell he did this, I don't know. He chartered a ship and took relief supplies to Russia. The Russian government was very appreciative. He became a friend of Lenin's.
Uh-huh.
And at one point he had a monopoly of the manufacture of pencils in Russia, among other things. Then, in the aftermath of the revolution, he and his brother were there, and they bought everything they could lay their hands on in the way of art objects.
Mm.
He became very knowledgeable about it, probably a bright guy.
Yeah.
And they brought them to the United States and sold them. Made a huge amount of money doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And he maintained his ties with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got an Occidental, and then the Occidental was just limping along, and they discovered oil in
Libya.
And he went over there and became a friend of whoever it was who controlled the Libyan government.
Mm-hmm.
He got the biggest concession there for Occidental. But anyway, it's all this history of that kind. God, I can't think of any of it.
Well,
I think
a lot of that history, a lot of the oil history that was written down in Ventura, you know, the geology was so much different in California than it had been in Pennsylvania.
Sure, sure.
And so they learned a lot about where oil was and why it was and where it was and stuff like that. So I got involved in that, and so any kind of a oil history book I kind of enjoy, I read Titan, the biography of our friend Rockefeller and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, you're right. Well, this God damn, why can't I think of the name of that book? It's a kind of a one word, and I'm sure that
I'm sure I can, look it up.
I'm sure you can get it on the internet.
Yeah, just look up, do a search on Arm & Hammer.
And it's interesting. It's got everything in it, but the guy does it so well, it's hard to put down. I think you'd love it.
Well, yeah. And, you know, just to watch the technology, like you were talking about, how the casings thing, and, you know, they did the first things with spring poles and
you,
all that.
Did you read the latest biography of Howard Hughes?
No, didn't do that.
Very good.
Again, about the oil tools and stuff
well,
like that?
Well, that's where the money came from.
Yeah, yeah.
His father just invented a better drill bit.
Yeah.
But his father, somebody had a stroke of genius. I mean, it was a stroke of genius to invent this bit.
Uh-huh.
His father was a wildcatter and sort of a hand-to-mouth thing. And then he, in some manner or other, married a Houston socialite lady, and he realized he had to do something to provide for her. So he sat down and sketched out this bit. And then he and a friend set it up. They didn't want anybody to see it, of course. They set it up in an old abandoned garage and warehouse. And had they drilled right through the cement floor. They dropped out of the basement and drilled through the basement floor. But the stroke,
surprise!
The stroke of genius was that they wouldn't sell it.
That's the thing. Only that I was. They leased it.
They had to come back to them to be sharpened.
Right.
And rebuilt.
And I think that the leasing of those things.
And
was,
then of course Howard just came. And Howard came along. His father died when he was just a kid.
Yeah.
And he was a rotten, spoiled kid who essentially almost never went to school. He never finished high school. But he could apparently
got interested in aviation.
He could fly an airplane. When he got down, he could sketch out for the engineers exactly what they needed to do to improve that airplane. Something about the aerodynamics of the wing or something, the tail or something mm-hmm. else. Mm-hmm. He had no training for it at all.
Hmm.
Just did it.
Just intuitive.
Yeah.
Well,
but that's a lot of, well, of course, there's much more about Howard's amatory exploits.
God, he's really a colorful guy. You know, when we lived down in Los Angeles,